College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Oh, we got some surprises from Week 8. Some good surprises, some bad surprises if you live in Madison. And if you are a Big Ten fan, we'll explain, of course. I am on the road in Philadelphia, licking my wounds after watching last night's debacle in Dallas with the Eagles and the Cowboys. And this city is very quiet and very weird right now when you talk about a vibe. And, you know, Kirk Herbstreit joining us as he does every Monday. You know, you want to talk about what's really weird. The vibe, I feel like, with Wisconsin and Champaign and how everything was supposed to be anticipated to be a big weekend. This is going to be the big showdown of the Big Ten East versus the Big Ten West and Ohio State, Wisconsin. And just everything about that game with Wisconsin was just really, really weird.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about when you're up in the top five, top 10 of the country, you're going to have that off week. Clemson had theirs. I mean, over the years, you can think about teams that just showed up and for whatever reason, you know, whether you're peeking ahead or you didn't have a great week of practice as far as respecting your opponent, whatever it might be. But, I'm not trying to take anything away from what Lovie Smith and Illinois did, because congratulations to Lovie, a historic win for the Illini. And for Lovie Smith, and it was exciting to see last second kick. I mean, that's all great for them. But shows like this, we usually talk about teams that are up in the top 10, and are they going to win? Are they going to lose? When they lose, we kind of react. So, as far as Wisconsin, I just thought they were outplayed. You know, it was a game that, as you said, even early, it just kind of felt a little bit weird. It felt like, you know, are they going to be able to escape the game? Because typically you can see kind of early if a team like Wisconsin's mentally locked in, you know, they're going to be up by a couple scores anyway. And it just had that sleepy kind of slow feel throughout, and Illinois wouldn't go away. And the longer they hung around, the more they were thinking, why not? Why not today? Mm-hmm. And the more Wisconsin was just trying to just one more play to try to put them away. And then that interception with about 2.5 minutes to go, and the Illini took advantage of it and got into field goal range and then hit it. And now you're left there. And another example for other teams. I can promise you there are coaches that have teams that are undefeated or up near the top of the conference race. And they're pulling out highlights and they're talking to their team about Wisconsin. They're using Wisconsin as an example of, if you don't show up and you don't prep, because you lose those games Monday through Friday in how you prepare. You don't lose it on Saturday. You lose it on your focus in meetings and on the practice field, and it carries over into the game. And every coach, like Paul Chryst, they all try to guard against it, but it's human nature. And sometimes it catches up to you and gets you. And in my opinion, that was a kind of a feisty Illinois team at home, and without a doubt a Wisconsin team peeking ahead and thinking about what could be in Columbus the next week, which is now this week.
30.5-point favorites.
Yeah.
And the play calling there on that 3rd and 5 with 2.5 minutes to go, and you're screaming. I think I was, and I'm sure a lot of Badger fans were like, take some time off the clock. Why are you throwing the ball when you have Jonathan Taylor in the backfield? And again, in the previous drive, Taylor did fumble, and there's some concerns about he has a history of fumbling, but we just highlighted him earlier in that game where he rushed for over 5,000 yards before the end of his junior season. So he's the one thing you can guarantee whether he's going to get the first down or not. You're just going to take more time off the clock, and you're forcing Illinois to potentially use a timeout. I just don't understand that.
Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, if they hit it, it's easy to say, wow, they caught him off guard, because everybody's expecting Jonathan Taylor in the running game. I mean, typically Paul Chryst is going to err on the side of a conservative approach. I mean, that's kind of what you'd expect with their style of offense. And I think if anything, he's a pretty good coach and pretty in tune with what he thinks the strength of his team is. I think they were just showing trust in the quarterback and the execution and trying to maybe catch Illinois off guard and try to hit a play. And obviously ended up backfiring on him.
Phenomenal interception by Adams there. And then, of course, the great storyline with the kicker and nailing that kick. He's from Ireland, and the celebration. He said he passed out while they were piling up on top of him. So good for Lovie Smith and Illinois getting that win. And a week ago, we had both of us, Wisconsin, I think most of the country had Wisconsin in the top six now. And with a new look here, can you give us your new top four here?
Hey, Kevin, before I get to my top four teams, let's take a look at the All-State playoff predictor. Allstate knows that football season is mayhem. That's why they're reminding fans that if mayhem can show up on game day, imagine what can happen the rest of the week. So go get better protected with Allstate. Yeah, for me, I have Ohio State still just a team that is the most complete team. I heard one of the coaches, I think it was Pat Fitzgerald, at his press conference saying after he played them and reviewed tape on them leading up to their game last Friday, he said it's the cleanest team he's seen in the country, meaning the defense, the offense. You're not seeing mental errors. You're seeing them play to their capabilities. You know, it's easy to fall in love with LSU and their offense and what they've done against Texas and Florida. It's easy to fall even in love with Alabama, who we'll talk about in a second, when Tua was in there and the way they're scoring points. You could make a case for Oklahoma. But as far as offense, defense, special teams, to me, that's where Ohio State has the edge, just a slight edge over some of these other teams. So I would still have them at one as the most complete team. I would move LSU to two, just because of the way they continue to kind of show who they are. I'd have Alabama almost a 2B, behind them at three. I'd have Clemson at four. And on the outside, knocking on the door very close, of course, would be Oklahoma. And I'd have Penn State now coming up into the top six, replacing Wisconsin after that loss.
And we'll be right back. But first, here's a message from Allstate.
Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today. Now back to the show.
All right, so when you take a look at that Wisconsin loss, would that be, you know, the biggest surprise over the weekend?
Yeah, I think it has to be the biggest surprise, just because, you know, you're talking about a 30-point underdog winning outright. There were a couple things within games that surprised me. Probably the game I called, you know, if I don't know if you saw all of it the Michigan team getting down 21-0, and after the way they played in Madison the last time they were on a road in a big game, and you know, they kind of fell apart. They didn't really fight back, and here they are down 21-0 in the whiteout against a Penn State team that just looked like it was getting stronger and stronger. You thought, man alive, this one potentially could get ugly. They got it to 21-7 at the half, but, you know, Penn State was getting the ball to start the second half, and you wondered if Michigan would be able to fight back. Maria Taylor interviewed Jim Harbaugh at halftime, and she asked him, you know, what he thought of the first half, and he said, this is about to be Michigan's finest hour, was his quote to her. And Chris and I kind of looked at each other like, wow, okay, let's see what happens. And to his credit and the Michigan team, boy, they came out and really fought. And I thought Shea Patterson made some plays, and their defense started to come up with some stops. In fact, I think they outgained Penn State 230-80 in the second half to kind of navigate and put themselves right where they wanted to be. They made a few plays. They got down inside the 10-yard line, and you know, Shea Patterson was looking for a fade stop to his left to Nico Collins, and ended up coming back, actually avoided a sack by Gross Matos, stepped up and then found Ronnie Bell and made a really good throw. And obviously Ronnie Bell unable to hold on to it. And that was the end of the game. But I thought that if there was a surprise, it was the way Michigan, on the road in that environment down 21-0 got back into a position, to tie the game there near the end of the ball game. So that was impressive.
I'm with you because he was doubling down on his team in the final two quarters, and that you know that environment. You saw it firsthand. You could feel you could feel the energy in the building too, where Penn State fans are saying, "Uh-oh, we're getting a little worried if this game goes into overtime. The momentum of those kids is going to change, and the attitude is going to completely change." One thing we need to point out. Yeah, you know, Ronnie Bell is so talented, and that kid busts his butt, and he makes so many plays for that offense, and there's tears streaming down his face on the sidelines. He understands what he just did, and you were outspoken on Twitter. I'm glad you fought back, and you voiced some opinions, some strong opinions about, you know, some fans, we're not painting a broad brush here, but some idiots out there that are going to go attack this young man. Like, it's foolish.
Yeah. And sadly, as I'm calling the game and he dropped the ball, and our replay showed that clearly he dropped it and it wasn't the defender getting a hand on it. It's sad that my first thought, maybe the dad in me with four boys, the dad in me right away thinks, oh no, you know, like this guy's going to get crushed on social media. That literally is one of my first thoughts, is I felt bad for Ronnie Bell. Not that he needs me to feel bad for him, but I did. I felt bad for him because I know what a competitor he is. I know what kind of game he had played up to that point. He was a big part of helping getting the Michigan offense going. Has been a great player all year. From what I hear, a wonderful person. The last thing that any competitive athlete wants to do is let his teammates down so then the camera catches him. You know, not that we were trying to like zone in on him crying. Well, our cameras just happened to go to him, and he's got tears in his eyes, and you could tell how much he was taking it personally. And because I was already anticipating it, and you made a good point, Michigan has an incredible fan base, and this is for every fan base. 90 to 95% of every fan base is incredible, in the corner with their team. They love their team. And Michigan and everybody else has that 5% of the fan base that you just want to hide from. Like, your own fans are embarrassed of them. You know what I mean? And of course they come out of the woods when something like this happens. And I just felt the need to just say, you know, you call yourself a fan, a kind of so-called Michigan fans. Here's a guy that's fighting for your school. And making big plays when you were cheering for him on those big first downs and doing everything he can to try to help the team win, drop the ball. Happens. And you're, instead of saying, oh man, you know, being sad and being upset, it's okay, but not to attack a guy. You just don't do that. I'm not an advocate of that. I'm not in the NFL. I'm not in college. And I just think it's unfortunate that a guy like Ronnie Bell, who does everything right, has to deal with that again from a very, very small vocal minority.
I'm glad you spoke up because it is ridiculous. And, you know, Michigan now, they go back home. They got
They still have some games coming up too.
Exactly. And you know what's crazy too? And I know Bear is going to talk a lot about this later this week, but Michigan's a 2.5 point favorite early this week against Notre Dame at home. And to me, it's like, whoa, somebody's telling me something here. Right. What's Vegas seeing that we need to understand?
Well, he would obviously know a lot better than you and I. And who knows, by the time they kick off, that could flip around. But they think about who they have left to play. And they're trying to, you know, have still a great year. They still can have a great year, but they've got Notre Dame this weekend. You got to go on the road against Maryland, who Mike Loxley's there and he's calling the plays, and you have the whole Josh Gattis thing, and you know, on the road, never easy in conference, and still have Michigan State, even though it's at home. Indiana, who, I mean, they're scoring points. Indiana's not a gimme at all. They're sitting there at 5-2. And then of course the last game at the end of the year. So, I don't know if any of those games are just no problems, show up and win kind of games. So they got to start this weekend. It's non-conference, traditional rivalry in Notre Dame to try to get things headed in the right direction. And Chris and Maria and I are looking forward to getting into Ann Arbor and calling that one Saturday night.
What's fascinating too, Herbie, and you mentioned it, and it's probably going to change, but your first initial reaction Monday morning, I look at the line, it's 2.5 points. This afternoon, it's Monday afternoon, just a few hours later, the line's now 1.5. So
yeah,
we'll see by the end of the week.
Right, exactly.
There's a lot of people early on that are feeling really good that they jumped in and got the Irish at 2.5, plus 2.5 in that matchup against Michigan. On the other side now from Penn State, you know, because listen, they got to go on a road and probably have an ugly game against Michigan State because that's what that tradition is. Penn State, Michigan State, it's going to be just ugly, right?
Yeah.
But if they survive that, they get the bye, and then that November 9th weekend, of course, all the hype's going to be about LSU and Alabama. We'll get to that conversation with Tua in a moment. But you have potentially Penn State undefeated on the road at undefeated Minnesota on November 9th. From what you saw from the Nittany Lions, what's your takeaway of Clifford and the way this offense looks? Because we know the defense is going to bring it. Where's the progress here for the Nittany Lions and quarterback?
Well, I really like him. People forget not just that Trace McSorley was there and did so much for that offense, but Tommy Stevens was one of the rare high-profile recruits that just kind of sat there and waited and waited and waited, and he was the heir apparent. He was the guy that was going to step in, and it wasn't until after spring ball. It wasn't like he left in the winter. He went through spring ball. Clearly didn't like the way things were going. Maybe Sean Clifford was putting the heat on him. In fact, in being there last week, I think he wanted to be declared the starter coming out of spring, and James Franklin was not willing to do that. He wanted to continue to fight and battle throughout the summer, and then he was going to make an announcement in camp. And I think Tommy Stevens said, wait a second, man, after all I've been through, I've been backing up Trace, waiting, playing running back, playing some tight end, playing receiver, being unselfish. You know, I deserve this. And I don't know whatever happened, but he goes to Mississippi State to play for Joe Moorhead. So here comes Sean Clifford, ready or not. And he comes out of a great high school program at Cincinnati St. X down in the Southwest Ohio area, and comes in with moxie and attitude, and really has worked hard to get better athletically, made some amazing throws to KJ Hamler, who you could put into a very small grouping of most electrifying player in the country, if not the most electrifying. So they've got a great thing going, and Penn State's going to have to continue to grow. I mean, for them to be able to go on the road and beat Michigan State, go on the road and beat Minnesota, go on the road and, of course, beat Ohio State, it's going to have to come more. Their offense is going to have to be more than just KJ Hamler. Clifford will have to continue to run. They're going to have to find Dotson maybe making more plays. Freiermuth, the big tight end. But they have capable bodies that I don't think people have seen yet. But I think if they end up having a magical run, then I think you'll see some of these other receivers and running backs step up and emerge to take some of the heat off of Clifford and Hamler. But I'm a big – I love that offensive style, big fan of it. And I think Clifford's doing a really good job of kind of engineering it at this point.
They're really explosive. You know, I think their biggest challenge is putting together long drives, right? Because with Hamler and Noah Kane in that backfield, and Stevens likes to move a little bit. He can. He's not like McSorley, but he can move a little bit. They can put together like a, you know, maybe 3 yard gain, 4 yard gain, boom. 70 yard gain. And that's what you're seeing with this offense.
And I think for them to hit those plays, the running game's going to have to continue to come on, whether it's Clifford or, you know, this committee of backs, not just Noah Kane, but obviously they've got four that they can roll in. Because when they run, that's when the safeties have to come down and worry about Clifford and his threat of running the backs. Now you get Hamler one-on-one, and there are not very many defensive backs that can stay with him one-on-one.
We talk about that explosive offense. Let's talk about another explosive offense that took a major hit, and we'll see how long that hit's going to last here, and that is Tua Tagovailoa. Going down in a very competitive game against Tennessee. I got to give the Volunteers a ton of credit. They were in that game for the majority of the night, until, you know, what happened in the fourth quarter and some drama. To me, the Tua injury, okay, ankle surgery on the other leg, because he had this a year ago and it was on the other leg. It was the left leg late last year. Mac Jones comes in. He's 6 of 11, 72 yards. when you look at the schedule, it benefits right now if you're going to have an injury to Tua, because you got Arkansas and then the bye before LSU. What is your biggest concern, or how do you measure this Alabama team this weekend against an Arkansas team that obviously everybody knows is down, but that you have Mac there before you get ready for LSU?
Yeah, a couple things. Number one, what are the odds of having this kind of procedure on both ankles? I mean, this mm-hmm. was kind of groundbreaking a year ago when we saw Tua have the injury and he went down in Atlanta against Georgia and had time to recover before the semifinal and then eventually the national championship to try to get healed up. Here, he's got, you know, 2.5-3 weeks till he's going to have to be ready to go. I think this week with Arkansas, I've seen enough of Mac Jones to know he's more than capable of moving the ball against a team like Arkansas. I mean, respectfully to Arkansas, I'm not even concerned about this week.
Yep.
It's more about where Tua will be in his recovery, in his rehab, which is very, very hard to predict after this week, the bye week, because he's so talented, he can sit there and get mental reps on that bye week and study LSU and really get tuned in. And then you hope to get a day or two of practice out of him the week leading into the game. And if at that point he's okay, here's the concern, though, is you're going to throw him out potentially. And I think what could be a shootout. I don't think Bama's mm-hmm. going to stop Joe Burrow. I just don't.
Yep.
I think LSU, if Tua's healthy, has a hard time stopping Tua in that offense. So the game means you need Tua healthy. And if he gets dinged or he has to scramble, you know, you just hold your breath every time he's in some kind of contact, because it's one thing to rest after a high ankle sprain, that procedure, give it 2.5-3 weeks. And then you go out. You really truly have not tested it until you get on the field that night. Now you're hoping somebody doesn't sack him. He doesn't have to scramble. There isn't some kind of collision that forces him to use instinctively extra effort. Now he's pushing to get that extra yard. Now he's straining that ankle and now he's back to square one. High ankle sprain, anybody that's ever had one knows if you force it a little bit early to come back, you're just a slight tweak away again from going all the way back where now you can't even walk on it. So it's a very, very unfortunate situation. And if you lose Tua, Mac Jones is capable, but he's not Tua. And so to me, until we see him on the field and how he responds to really testing it that night or that afternoon, we're not going to really know much about it. It's very difficult to predict. Hopefully he's healthy. Hopefully he's able to go, because all of us want to see healthy Tua in Alabama versus a healthy Joe Burrow in LSU. May the better team win, but I hate that he's already a little gimpy going into the game.
Yeah, it's a shame too, because I think we've circled November 9th since the second week of the season, where we're like, all right, the way this is trending, man, it's going to be a phenomenal environment. And it's a shame because, again, you want to see both those guys, both quarterbacks healthy, both offenses going back and forth, because it could if Alabama loses in a scenario like this where Tua is not healthy and LSU runs the table, you enter a lot of other questions down the road about if other teams lose and how do teams match up with one losses. And then Alabama's conversation is, well, they had an injury even though they didn't win their own division, right? And
then it
gets a little murky, right?
Right.
Then we've got a lot of conversations that first weekend and second weekend of December. We'll be back in a minute with more from Herbie and his thoughts on Week 8, but let's pause for a moment to hear from our sponsors, AT&T and Dr. Pepper. Yeah, college football is great unless, of course, it's just okay. Like when students decide to paint their chests with different letters to spell some word, and then they stand together to get on TV, but they're spelling the word wrong, or they lined up in the wrong order. Sure, not everybody's an English major, and I get it. We can't all win the national spelling bee. But come on, people. You should know how to spell Wildcats or Bulldogs. The purpose isn't to have a word jumble in the student section to keep your mind sharp or something. Just okay is not okay, whether it's college football fans or your wireless network. You want to watch the best college football just like you want to go with AT&T, America's best network. Don't settle for typos on people's chests, and don't settle for anything less than the best wireless network. Get the best college football and get AT&T. Best network based on GWS OneScore, September 2019. Make sure to tune in to my new favorite TV show, Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper, returning every Saturday throughout the college football season during the commercials. Fansville is the only show that stars Dr. Pepper, puts the spotlight on fans, and perfectly captures the emotional roller coaster that is the college football season. Critics are saying it's good, fantastic, is anyone else thirsty, and literally the best thing since Diet Dr. Pepper and Dr. Pepper Cherry. In Fansville, Dr. Pepper delivers a tour de force performance alongside legendary college football co-stars Brian the Boz Bosworth and Eddie George. Experience the pain, the passion, and the deliciousness of college football fandom this fall on Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper. So pull over, veer right, slant left, do what you gotta do to get to your local store and pick up some refreshing ice-cold Dr. Pepper, the official drink of Fansville. And hey, while you're at it, don't be afraid to go for two.
You had mentioned about a surprise. I would just add in the SEC, just to stay in the SEC for a second, the Florida-South Carolina game that,
yep,
you know, I think a lot of us were very interested to see Florida, after beating Auburn, where it's high profile, big stage, how are they going to do against, you know, Gus Malzahn and Kevin Steele and that defense? And is Trask up to it to face this kind of a defense in the SEC? And boy, did he answer the call, and they end up with a big win. And now the very next week, they got to go on the road to Death Valley. It's a night game. And how's Trask going to deal with this, and how the Gators going to deal with the emotions of Death Valley at night? And boy, I thought they put their best foot forward, came up a little bit short. Tough loss for them to have to deal with. Now a third week. Now they get to go to Columbia and yeah, deal with a South Carolina team who just had a huge win against Georgia. And they're thinking about, hey, let's keep the mojo going. And it's 10-10 at halftime. And then South Carolina takes the lead and going into the fourth quarter. And the Gators put up 21 points in the fourth quarter to kind of hold serve and put themselves right where they need to be before the game in Jacksonville in a couple weeks. Now they get to a bye week, get a chance to recover and get healthy. And that was impressive, because that was a test not only against a confident South Carolina team, but a test, as I said, for the third week in a row. I thought the Gators continue to really impress everybody with the way they're playing. Dan Mullen doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, and that's a great point too, especially with that bye, because they went in that game against South Carolina without Grenard and Zuniga, and
right,
they didn't get those guys right before,
yep,
Georgia. That's going to be, to me, the difference in a game like that, where Georgia's going to need their running attack after how slow they started against Kentucky in that first half, where they're scoreless, and you're like, uh-oh, what's going on,
yeah,
with the Bulldogs right now?
Yeah, and it's back-to-back weeks, and Georgia had the rain, and I understand that, and I'm a Jake Fromm guy. Like, he could hire, yeah, me to be his PR guy. Like, I've loved Jake Fromm for 3 years. When people talk Justin Fields a year ago, I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. You're talking about maybe the best leader in the country. You want to replace him, mm-hmm, with a potentially talented five-star? Let's hold on, you know. And so I love Jake Fromm. The problem is, I told you this last week, they're not getting the ball downfield. They're not, yep, stretching the field. And I don't know if they don't have the receivers. I don't know what it is. I don't know if they don't feel the need to try to do that. But against Notre Dame, they finally did it late in that game in the fourth quarter, and they had some success. Against South Carolina, it never happened. Against Kentucky, you didn't see it happen very much. So against Florida, if they continue to just play high percentage throws, dink and dunk will not be enough. Swift alone against that kind of defense that's pressuring the line of scrimmage, because there's no threat of anything downfield, that'll be a tough day for Georgia. They're going to have to find out a way to get the ball thrown vertically, or they're not going to beat Florida. So it'll be interesting to see what they do as they get ready for with their bye to get ready for Florida.
When I started the conversation a little bit about the SEC, you know, I did mention, you know, Tennessee keeping that game, and a credit to the Volunteers playing really, really tough in that game. But unfortunately, the storyline on the Tennessee side against Alabama is what happened with Jeremy Pruitt and his behavior on the sidelines when Jared Garantano went for it. And there's a question of whether it was the right call or did he improvise? And it's a 28-13 game in the fourth quarter. They're on the goal line and they get stuffed a couple of times against Bama's front line. And then, you know, the fumble, and that changes the entire momentum of the game. And it's really going back to the sidelines, and Pruitt was under a lot of heat Saturday night into Sunday on grabbing the face mask. And if you look at the video, it's not so much of a hard grab. It's just the whole thing. It's the whole thing of where Tennessee is, where Jeremy Pruitt is, and the behavior of losing his mind the way he did against Garantano. What was your first thoughts? Because again, people go crazy to both extremes. And I think that sometimes we forget about nuance in the middle, that there's certain things in certain moments that, okay, it's football. It's happened in the past. But then you say, okay, maybe you shouldn't have done that, considering that the spotlight's now all on you as the coach and your behavior, no longer on the performance and how well they played at least for three quarters.
Yeah, I never heard a clear definition or explanation of what happened as far as did he improvise? Did he audible on his
Know. I mean,
nothing has come out yet still.
Nothing that I've seen about it, like if he improvised. If you look at the video, it looks like he, it wasn't a quarterback sneak. At least it wasn't, when you see the guard pull, it's clear that that wasn't the play design.
Okay. Let me ask you this. And for everybody listening, best way to explain this to people who are parents, is if you've asked your kids to not do something, you know, 100 times, and then that 101st time you see them do it again, you really got to check yourself emotionally to not just lose your mind, right?
Yes.
And I think the way you look at a coach in a situation like that, where a program is desperately trying to turn the corner, desperately, hey, they're competing. I mean, they're in Tuscaloosa. They're potentially getting within a possession. If they score and get the 2-point conversion, I mean, they're right there, right? And two is out of the game. I mean, you're talking about a very different conversation we're having right now, if Tennessee scores there. So at the very, nonetheless, they were competing in the game. And so, and you're talking about a coach that's lost some embarrassing games in these last couple of years. So he's been like trying to steer the Titanic, right? Mm-hmm. And I think with that particular player, since he's been there, I think there've been some moments where he's probably done a pretty good job of biting his tongue and just not losing his mind. And for him to react that way, he's a very competitive guy, and I'm not making excuses for him at all, but I think it has to be a culmination of a number of things and frustration with that play. I mean, it was a 14-point swing the other way, and maybe with Jared himself, maybe there's been some issues, and it was just like for him to grab, you know, even with a finger, grab the face mask. It tells me that there's maybe some pinned up frustration there. And the fact that Garantano has been benched, you know, earlier in the year for a younger quarterback. I don't know all the backstory. I don't know what's going on, but when I see something like that, and I'm from a different generation, I don't have a problem with a coach yelling at a player or grabbing his face mask. Now, you don't want to, like, was it Lou Holtz or somebody grabbed the face mask and walked like 10 yards down the, the field? I mean, I don't know if in this generation or today's player you can do that, but I don't have a problem. And if it's my son, I don't have a problem with a coach, undressing him and getting after him. What's the difference between that and what Dabo Sweeney did to a kicker? I mean, Dabo Sweeney, he didn't grab his face mask, but he undressed that kicker. Just destroyed him verbally. And I feel like that was more excessive than Jeremy Pruitt, who was furious and grabbed his face mask for a second. I think that's maybe people making more out of that than maybe needs to be.
And you can definitely see Overreaction City happening on Twitter as that's unfolding in real time. Because nuance does not exist on that app, by the way.
How about out west with USC we talked all year, their first six games, you know, are they going to be 3-3? Are they going to be 2-4? Clay Helton, everybody talking about Clay Helton's job every week is in jeopardy. So they end up losing to Notre Dame. And by the way, a couple weeks ago, they battled with Notre Dame. They've had to deal with three different quarterbacks, this tough schedule, 3-3. Uh-huh. And everybody's like, all right, now let's see what they do with Arizona and Colorado. They still have Oregon and Arizona State. They have Cal out there. What's going to happen? Is SC going to be okay? And I know it's Arizona, and you could say Arizona's not a great team, but they've been scoring points on everybody that they played. And I was pleasantly surprised to see USC not just win, but really put it on Arizona in a impressive way. And it makes me somewhat look down the future and start to think about, because USC, of course, beat Utah on a Friday night. They have the head-to-head advantage with Utah. And when you look at their schedule that's remaining, yeah, there's some challenging games. The Oregon game, of course, will be tough, but it is at the Coliseum. If they were to win out, or even if, you know, Utah still has some tough games, my point is they could finish 8-4, or they could finish 9-3. And you know where they would go? The Pac-12 championship game.
Yeah, exactly.
That we're guy that everybody South. Wants to yeah. fire, they could still end up in a Pac-12 championship game. So I'm keeping a very close eye on them, and to just see if they're able to stay healthy and keep winning games. But I'd be careful writing off Clay Helton just yet for the SC fans that seem to want to put Urban Meyer in that spot, put this guy in that spot. Everybody has an answer for who should be the head coach at USC. And meanwhile, they may end up still getting to the Pac-12 title game.
And I've said this a handful of times, you know, on the podcast or throughout the whole season, on the air. USC is a completely different team at home as well, right?
Yeah.
And when
yep.
you get the opportunity, like they pull the upset off against Utah at home, they win against Arizona at home, it's homecoming. And then that Oregon game, I mean, Justin Herbert showed me a lot in that second half against Seattle, against Washington in Seattle on the road where they're down by 14 points and he has to figure out a way. He has to find a way to win. And I felt like, okay, this is the Justin Herbert we've been waiting for this second half, right?
Right.
And the Ducks are led by that defensive front. They play really tough, but Herbert had four touchdowns and yep. no picks. He yep. was brilliant in the second half.
I'm glad you brought that up. That was the next game, and that was a fun one to watch. I love watching games in Seattle when the Huskies are rolling. They're playing good football, and it's a big-time matchup. There's something about that city. They love football. They love sports. They really love their Seahawks, 12th man, and they love their Huskies. And it is a difficult environment to go into for anybody, let alone their big rival. Oregon and Washington, you get up into the Pacific Northwest, it's ugly. You know, and no matter who has a home field advantage, whether you're going to Husky Stadium there in Seattle or you're going down to Autzen, it's a big time advantage. And for Oregon to come back the way they did, defense finally makes a play here and there, get the ball back to Herbert, and you're right. Everybody wants to see Herbert because he's had moments when the game's been on the line. He hasn't really shown that eye of the tiger, that mental and physical toughness to get his team to that finish line, to demand a win. And in maybe the toughest environment he's ever played in, with as much at stake as any game he's ever played in, they go and they find a way to win at 35-31. And again, a topic that always wants to come up. What's the odds of the Pac-12? Are they still lingering? Are they still potentially in the discussion for a playoff? And, you know, we're going to have more teams that are going to lose ahead of them. But I think people are premature to leave Oregon out of the potential debate. If they were to win out and finish with a Pac-12 championship and they're 12-1 and that one loss is essentially on the last play to Auburn on a neutral site where they were willing to play that game. Instead of saying, yep. hey, we're going to play whoever out west, we'll play that game. Put us in. We'll play Auburn in Jerry Jones' stadium. And you're telling me they outplay Auburn for the majority of that game, an SEC team, and then they lose late where they give up a touchdown pass, and they're not even worth a discussion for that fourth playoff spot? I'd be one guy that's sitting there stating their case and at least bringing up their side of the story, because – 9 conference games. There's never a break out west. It's a brutal grind. And then you throw Auburn in on top of that. So let's see. They may not win them all, but if they do, mm-hmm. They're going to have a very strong case, in my opinion.
And we will be watching the committee too. And you know who's going to be watching the committee? A bunch of ADs saying, well, then why am I going to schedule something out of a non-conference, right? That's going to be tough.
Exactly.
Because look, it's costing us, even though, like you mentioned, you go to on the biggest stage and you dominate, or at least you lead most of the game, and you lose in the final seconds of a fantastic matchup, then you got to pay for it the rest of the season.
Yeah, should we start scheduling Montanas and the Nevadas?
Exactly.
And should I do that just to stay undefeated? Committee, if that's what it's about, then count me out of playing in these big-time neutral site games or these intersectional games. I want nothing to do with it. You're telling me, hey, you're not undefeated. Oklahoma's undefeated. You're not undefeated.
Yep.
Message is sent to me and all my AD friends. We got it. We'll stay. And that's bad for the sport. That's bad for the players. It's bad for the fans. Who wants to watch Oregon play Montana? Wouldn't you rather see Oregon play Auburn? And so the committee needs to really consider that. And the tiebreaker, when there's that cluster, one of the things is the non-conference scheduling. Who's willing to step out and take a chance? And that's why I think, even though they lost the game on basically a last play, Oregon has, I don't want to say trump card because they didn't win the game, but they to me have a little bit of a case to be made because of that willingness to play in that game.
I'm glad you're bringing all that stuff up because again, there have been many games that were really boring and boring matchups this season, right? Where you're like, we can't wait till mid-October we can't wait till November because there have been so many matchups. You're like, these games really are not fun. They're like, they're 30 point spreads, 25 point spreads. There's nothing entertaining about it. And then we have a bunch of undefeated teams, but we can't have a measuring stick until they get into the deep part of their conference scheduling. So, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. If Oregon runs the table the rest of the way, they definitely deserve to be in a conversation if we are looking at teams with one losses.
Absolutely.
Stacked up here.
Yep.
All right. We've got a bunch of questions. Before we get to that, one clarification. While we're talking, Taylor, our producer, outstanding producer, just let us know that, Pruitt said that there was just a miscommunication with Garantano. He wouldn't expand any further about that. And that sounds like a coach protecting his player in that environment, right?
Yep.
Okay. We got questions for Herbie here, from our listeners. We got three pretty good ones. We appreciate you guys, rating the show and then putting in your questions for Herbie. Here's the first one. Jude wants to know, with your sons attending Clemson and going through the recruiting process, what advice would you give to parents who are about to go through that same experience?
I think the big thing is, just get a feel for the coaches. Try to, you know, when you're around the coaches and you're just to kind of have your eyes open, your ears open, and you're just paying attention to not only how they treat maybe your son, but how they treat others in the room and just how they carry themselves, and do your research on not just what happens on the football field, but maybe what happens with these players academically, what happens to these players, just this is the dad in me, what happens to these players after they graduate, how they're treated when they're at the program, whether they're a star player or they're, you know, an offensive guard that nobody knows his name, or they're a guy that doesn't get a chance to play as often. How are they treated? How are they handled as people, not just as players? The campus, the lifestyle, there's just so much that goes into it. But for me, it was really as much about the culture of the program and the university as much as anything.
Good stuff there. Got another question here from B. Matthews. He asks, Utah's Tyler Huntley has had one of the highest QB efficiency ratings in the country. Why don't you think he gets more love on a national level? Everyone talks about Herbert, Khalil, Jaden Daniels, but don't you think he's deserving of more praise, especially after the win over Arizona State?
Absolutely. In fact, last week on game day, the reason I picked Utah, everybody wants to pick them because of their defense. I picked them because this is no longer Kyle Whittingham. When you close your eyes and I say Kyle Whittingham, you think of physical defense. It's almost like old Alabama. They're going to keep them in the game with defense. They're going to run the ball, and they're going to get just enough from their passing game. They've been able to win a ton of games with that kind of recipe that's allowed them to have a lot of success. it's no longer the case this year. I mean, now you got a quarterback that's completing 74% of his passes, 9-1 touchdown to interception ratio. His QBR is among the tops in the country. And he's got some playmakers on the outside that are doing a really good job led by Thompson. So I, at least on game day, I can't speak for everybody, but I know on game day, we talk often, about Utah, and we talk a lot about Huntley and this not being a typical Utah team that's just winning with defense and field position and special teams and kind of the old fashioned way. They're able to open it up and obviously can still run the ball with Zach Moss too. So they're a real team. And, Lee Corso picked them to go to the playoff, before the season started. So we like Utah on our show.
He's completing 74% of his passes, and he just threw his first pick of the season. So 9 touchdowns, 1 pick. The one thing is, Huntley, for him, is just staying healthy, right? He's just got to stay on the field to give the youth a shot. I really like Utah. I've liked them from the get-go here. Let's continue our questions. Our final one, and I like this one a lot because, you know, if you're a fan of football on Saturdays and Sundays, it has become a storyline, especially on Sundays. Here it is. What do you make of the way pass interference is called in college versus the NFL? 15-yard penalty versus a spot foul. Do you think pass interference is only costing a team 15 yards encourages more penalties when defenders have clearly been beaten?
Yeah, I think it does. And you could see in games that you watch, when a guy gets behind a defensive back, especially late in the game, they just grab their jersey knowing that, you know, what the heck, it's 15 yards instead of a touchdown to lose the game. I don't know. I should talk to Rogers Redding about that. He's a supervisor of officials for the nation. Why don't I talk to him between now and next Monday and see if there's ever any thought or consideration about changing that, or if it seems like it's, in the foreseeable future or practical that they might reevaluate that. As much as the passing game is being more and more involved in offenses and game plans, it's a different era today. And, you know, to the credit of the officials and the rules committee, a lot of times they're willing to kind of go along with strategy and with the change of the game. So I think it's a very good question. It's one that I'll bring up to Rogers this week, and next week let's put a TBD on that, and I'll answer that next week and see how real that seems to be. But for me, I would love to see it changed. I think it would make it a lot better on games late in the game when guys defensively are kind of cheating the system a bit and knowing that they're not going to really get penalized. You watch an NFL game, you get an interference call at the 3-yard line. Wow. I mean, you're talking about 40 yards, you know, so it's a big, big difference.
Dramatic momentum shift on any pass interference in the NFL these days going down the field.
Are you going to be with your Eagles? I mean, that was a tough one.
Oh, God. Herbie, it was bad. Like, really, really bad. I'm not in a good spot, especially that they got the Bills this coming week. And, you know, for me, it being from the city where we just care about whether you care as much as we care. They didn't care last night. It just didn't look like they were interested in the game. And Cowboy Week's a big week. And I won't bring it up. I won't bring it up for you because I really, watching Red Zone yesterday, I felt bad for every single Bengal fan I know.
Yeah.
Are you a Bengal guy? Is that you? Cause I know you like the Reds. Are you a Bengal guy?
Growing up in Ohio, I am a passionate, blinded Reds fan. I'm a huge Columbus Blue Jackets fan. I watch, if I'm home, my son Chase and I, we watch every game starting at now. Like, we're those guys who can watch game one all the way through. Love the Blue Jackets. Obviously love Ohio State when, you know, before I played there. And even now I'm a huge Ohio State fan, basketball and football and really anything. And with the Bengals, I grew up more of a Cowboys fan because you got to remember I grew up in that era where Roger Staubach and Tony Dorsett were America's team, and the Bengals they were really average. Got a little bit better with Ken Anderson and Isaac Curtis and Chris Collinsworth, and so I started to follow them. And Boomer Esiason, I mean, they had some good. Then it was easy to kind of be a fan, but man, the last 10 years have been not just bad with losing, but the ownership drives you crazy. Vontaze Burfict doing things that were embarrassing. Pac-Man Jones. Uh-huh. It became a very, very hard franchise to even care about. And so I've been following since I live in Nashville and I'm good friends with Braves. I kind of follow the Titans and hope to see Braves and that team do well. They had a close one and
wow.
were able to find a way to get a win and a big time goal line stand there at the end.
Yeah. And if you're a Chargers fan, it's heartbreak once again. That was a wild game.
Like, how about the fumbles and the reviews? I've never seen anything like that at the end of a game.
And then they're waiting and everybody's sitting there waiting, wondering while time's going off the clock.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? The Chargers don't have a timeout. Can we make a decision?
And I know. In fact, the officials kind of came together. It was 9, 8 and they're kind of all looking at each other. Are you going to call it? Am I going to call it? Meanwhile, all the bodies are piled up. At the very least, the clock should have ran out. Like, you know, I mean, either signal touchdown or let the clock keep rolling. Nobody really knew what to do, but
it was wild.
That is gut-wrenching. Gut-wrenching. You're right, if you're a Chargers fan.
In just a minute, Herbie's going to share which matchup he's most excited to see in Week 9. But first, a word from Carhartt.
You know who works hard? Rookies. Sure, they make mistakes, but no one's got more to prove. Knowing each day's another opportunity to outwork them all and earn the respect they deserve. Point is, no one outworks a rookie. That's why after 130 years, Carhartt is still approaching each day with the passion and work ethic of a company that's 130 years young. Same hunger, same determination, same giant chip on the shoulder. And in the same way a rookie needs to work hard to earn the respect of their peers, everything Carhartt makes has to keep earning the respect of the hardworking people who wear it. That's why Carhartt still works like a rookie, and why Carhartt will keep outworking them all for the next 130 years, too. Visit Carhartt.com/CFB to learn more and shop this season's hardest working gear. Now back to the show.
Now, before I let you go, usually at the end of I ask you the game you're most looking forward to, and I circle some of these games, and we've talked a little bit about Wisconsin, Ohio State, and briefly Auburn, LSU, a little bit at least of LSU, and we talked to Penn State, Michigan State, Notre Dame at Michigan, we talked a little bit, but I want to know about your thoughts for game day going to South Dakota, and that number one versus number three matchup and this Dakota Markle rivalry. Like, what are your thoughts heading into a game like this where you guys get to embrace the environment and understand what it's all about?
Well, you know, I think it's when we first started to make a trip like this, being a traditionalist would think, man, why aren't we going to that game? Or why aren't we going to that game? And where are we going? Fargo, North Dakota, you know, and then we made a couple of these and I, you know, I'll be the first one to admit I was unclear why we were doing that. And then we went and I absolutely loved it. We went to a game there in Philly, Penn and Harvard.
Temple, Notre Dame. Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And Temple, Notre Dame. I mean, we've done some going way back where Lee Corso dressed up like Benjamin Franklin. It was just cool to see and be reminded that college football and the passion and the emotion affects every division. You know, it's not just Alabama and LSU and all these big time games that you go to. And I think shedding light on JMU, you know, we go to James Madison or mm-hmm. we get a chance to go to Army Navy every year, or we get a chance to go in this case to South Dakota and have a chance to see the Bison on the road. You know, it's just so cool to shed some light on these rivalries, on this level of football, on the caliber of players that are playing at this level. And I don't know, man, it's very refreshing and fun. Of course, we'll get right back in gear, I'm sure, the next week and go back to a big time Power 5 game. But this is a week that I think all of us on the show have learned to really embrace and look forward to and have a lot of fun with. And, you know, game day rolls into town, and no matter where we go, people are typically pretty excited and appreciative. And this is a week where I think we'll really have a lot of fun on the show and do the best we can to celebrate that rivalry.
And some context too. I mean, Brookings, South Dakota is going to be rocking because, you know, the two-time defending champs, the FCS at North Dakota State, they're coming in riding a 28-game winning streak, the second longest in the history of the FCS. And it began after losing to South Dakota State in the last visit to Brookings in 2017. So you've got so many storylines. I know you guys are going to have an absolute blast in that environment and kind of like that fresh juice when you go to a new place, right? Where everybody comes out. I know you had a blast with the whiteout, and there were so many people there Saturday in Happy Valley that morning. Yeah. It looked so much fun. And the cool thing is that you're at a Division I high level environment, and you're going to get that same type of environment in an FCS environment with North Dakota, South Dakota.
And I'll predict right now, this will be at the end of the year when you and I are sitting around looking back at the season and the highs and the lows. And, you know, we talk about incredible games and atmospheres. I'm going to predict right now that when we go this weekend, that this will be one of the shows that you say, what was a show or two that really stood out to you this year? I bet you this weekend will be that show. I bet it'll be one of those shows that is one of the more memorable shows. Incredible crowd. It'll be a great, like I said, it'll be a very cool celebration. And by the way, we're previewing, as you said, a big rivalry and a meaningful game with 1-3. So, and we're covering, like we do on game day, we'll be breaking down Ohio State, Wisconsin, Notre Dame, Michigan, LSU, Auburn, all the games around the country. But it'll be a great setting, I think, for a great day of college football on Saturday.
Good stuff, Herbie. I'll see you on Tuesday on SportsCenter, my man.
All right, bud. Safe travels. Have a good night tonight.
I want to thank our sponsors here for today's podcast, Allstate, AT&T, Dr. Pepper, and Carhartt. Also, our producer, Taylor Schwenk, on the other side. Check out our brand new podcast, ESPN Daily. Cannot wait for this. Hosted by Mina Kimes, Monday through Friday. She takes a look at the most interesting stories at ESPN in just 20 minutes. Listen and subscribe now to ESPN Daily, wherever you find your podcast. Coming up on Wednesday, Pollock's going to join us. Plenty to dive into after he gets out of his man cave, after watching the tape. And also, I've got a bone to pick with him. Find out in a couple days.